decades of the 20th century, the percentage would be even lower. One estimate, which includes American war deaths as well, comes in at less than 1%. Recently, the study of war has been made more precise by the release of two quantitative data sets, which I will explain in Chapter 5. They conservatively list about 40 million battle deaths during the 20th century. Battle deaths refer to soldiers and civilians who were directly killed in combat. If we consider that a bit more than 6 billion people died during the 20th century, and put aside some demographic subtleties, we may estimate that around 0.7% of the world's population died in battles during that century. Even if we tripled or quadrupled the estimate to include indirect deaths from war-caused famine and disease, it would barely narrow the gap between state and non-state societies. What if we added the deaths from genocides, purges, and other man-made disasters? Matthew White, the atrocitologist we met in Chapter 1, estimates that around 180 million deaths can be blamed on all of these human causes put together. That still amounts to only 3% of the deaths in the 20th century. Now let's turn to the present. According to the most recent edition of the Statistical Abstract of the United States, 2,448,017 Americans died in 2005. It was one of the country's worst years for war deaths in decades, with the armed forces embroiled in conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Together, the two wars killed 945 Americans, amounting to 0.0004, 0.004% of American deaths that year. Even if we throw in the 18,124 domestic homicides, the total rate of violent death adds up to 0.008, or 0.008%. In other Western societies, the rates were even lower. And in the world as a whole, the Human Security Report Project counted 17,400 deaths that year that were directly caused by political violence, war, terrorism, genocide, and killings by warlords and militias, for a rate of 0.0003, 0.003%. It's a conservative estimate, comprising only identifiable deaths. But even if we generously multiplied it by 20 to estimate undocumented battle deaths and indirect deaths from famine and disease, it would not reach the 1% mark. The major cleft in the statistics, then, separates the anarchical bands and tribes from the governed states. But we have been comparing a motley of collection from archaeological digs, ethnographic tallies, and modern estimates, some of them calculated on the proverbial back of an envelope. Is there some way to juxtapose two data sets directly, one from hunter-gatherers, the other from settled civilizations, matching the people, era, and methods as closely as possible? The economists Richard Steckel and John Wallace recently looked at data on 900 skeletons of Native Americans, distributed from southern Canada to South America, all of whom died before the arrival of Columbus. They divided the skeletons into hunter-gatherers and city-dwellers, the latter from the civilizations in the Andes and Mesoamerica, such as the Incas, Aztecs, and Mayans. The proportion of hunter-gatherers that showed signs of violent trauma was 13.4%, which is close to the average for the hunter-gatherers. The proportion of city-dwellers that showed signs of violent trauma was 2.7%, which is close to the figures for state societies before the present century. So holding many factors constant, we find that living in a civilization reduces one's chances of being a victim of violence fivefold. Let's turn to the second way of quantifying violence, in which the rate of killing is calculated as a proportion of living people, rather than dead ones. This statistic is harder to compute from boneyards, but easier to compute from most other sources, because it requires only a body count and a population size, not an inventory of deaths from other sources. The number of deaths per 100,000 people per year is the standard measure of homicide rates, and I will use it as the yardstick of violence throughout the book. To get a feel for what these numbers mean, keep in mind that the safest place in human history, Western Europe at the turn of the 21st century has a homicide rate in the neighborhood of 1 per 100,000 per year. Even the gentlest society will have the occasional young man who gets carried away in a barroom brawl, or an old woman who puts arsenic in her husband's tea, so that is pretty much as low as homicide rates ever go. Among Western countries, the United States lies at the dangerous end of the range. In the worst years of the 1970s and 1980s, it had a homicide rate of around 10 per 100,000, and its notoriously violent cities like Detroit had a rate of around 45 per 100,000. If you were living in a society with a homicide rate in that range, you would notice the danger in everyday life. And as the rate climbed to 100 per 100,000, the violence would start to affect you personally. Assuming you have 100 relatives, friends, and close acquaintances, then over the course of a decade, one of them would probably be killed. If the rate soared to 1,000 per 100,000, 1%, you'd lose about one acquaintance a year and would have a better-than-even lifetime chance of being murdered yourself. Let's look at war death rates for 27 non-state societies, combining hunter-gatherers and hunter-horticulturalists, and 9 that are ruled by states. The average annual rate of death in warfare for the non-state societies is 524 per 100,000, about half of 1%. Among states, the Aztec Empire of Central Mexico, which was often at war, had a rate about half that. Below that bar, we find the rates for 4 state societies during the centuries in which they waged their most destructive wars. 19th-century France fought the Revolutionary, Napoleonic, and Franco-Prussian Wars and lost an average of 70 people per 100,000 per year. The 20th century was blackened by 2 world wars that inflicted most of their military damage on Germany, Japan, and Russia, USSR, which also had a civil war and other military adventures. Their annual rates of death work out to 144, 27, and 135 per 100,000, respectively. During the 20th century, the United States acquired a reputation as a warmonger, fighting in 2 world wars and in the Philippines, Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq. But the annual cost in American lives was even smaller than those of the other great powers of the century, about 3.7 per 100,000. Even if we add up all the deaths from organized violence for the entire world for the entire century, wars, genocides, purges, and man-made famines, we get an annual rate of around 60 per 100,000. For the year 2005, the numbers representing the United States and the entire world would be almost invisible on a graph. So by this measure, too, states are far less violent than traditional bands and tribes. Modern Western countries, even in their most war-torn centuries, suffered no more than around a quarter of the average death rate of non-state societies, and less than a tenth of that for the most violent one. Though war is common among foraging groups, it is certainly not universal. Nor should we expect it to be, if the violent inclinations in human nature are a strategic response to the circumstances, rather than a hydraulic response to an inner urge. According to 2 ethnographic surveys, 65 to 70% of hunter-gatherer groups are at war at least every 2 years, 90% engage in war at least once a generation, and virtually all the rest report a cultural memory of war in the past. That means that hunter-gatherers often fight, but they can avoid war for long stretches of time. The Andaman Islanders of the Indian Ocean are recorded as having an annual death rate of 20 per 100,000, well below the average for non-state peoples, which exceeds 500 per 100,000. But they are known to be among the fiercest hunter-gatherer groups left on Earth. Following the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami, a worried humanitarian group flew over to the islands in a helicopter and were relieved to be met with a fusillade of arrows and spears, signs that the Andamanese had not been wiped out. 2 years later, a pair of Indian fishers fell into a drunken sleep and their boat drifted ashore on one of the islands. They were immediately slain, and the helicopter sent to retrieve their bodies was also met with a shower of arrows. There are, to be sure, hunter-gatherers and hunter-horticulturalists such as the Samai, who have never been known to engage in the protracted collective killings that can be called warfare. Anthropologists of peace have made much of these groups, suggesting that they could have been the norm in human evolutionary history, and that it is only the newer and wealthier horticulturalists and pastoralists who engage in systematic violence. The hypothesis is not directly relevant to this chapter, which compares people living in anarchy with those living under states, rather than hunter-gatherers with everyone else. But there are reasons to doubt the hypothesis of hunter-gatherer innocence anyway. The rates of death in warfare in these societies, though lower than those of horticulturalists and tribesmen, overlap with them considerably. And as I have mentioned, the hunter-gatherer groups we observe today may be historically unrepresentative. We find them in parched deserts or frozen wastelands where no one else wants to live. And they may have ended up there because they can keep a low profile and vote with their feet whenever they get on each other's nerves. As van der Denen comments, most contemporary peaceful foragers have solved the perennial problem of being left in peace by splendid isolation, by severing all contacts with other peoples, by fleeing and hiding, or else by being beaten into submission, by being tamed by defeat, by being pacified by force. For example, the Kung San of the Kalahari Desert, who in the 1960s were extolled as a paradigm of hunter-gatherer harmony, in earlier centuries had engaged in frequent warfare with European colonists, their Bantu neighbors, and one another, including several all-out massacres. The low rates of death in warfare in selected small-scale societies can be misleading in another way. Though they may avoid war, they do commit the occasional murder, and their homicide rates can be compared to those of modern state societies. The Samai are a hunting and horticulturalist tribe who were described in a book called The Samai, a Nonviolent People of Malaya, and who go out of their way to avoid the use of force. While there aren't many Samai homicides, there aren't many Samai. When the anthropologist Bruce Nauft did the arithmetic, he found that their homicide rate was 30 per 100,000 per year, which puts it in the range of the infamously dangerous American cities in their most violent years and at three times the rate of the United States as a whole in its most violent decade. The same kind of long division has deflated the peaceful reputation of the Kung, the subject of a book called The Harmless People, and of the Central Arctic Inuit, Eskimos, who inspired a book called Never in Anger. Not only do these harmless, nonviolent, anger-free people murder each other at rates far greater than Americans or Europeans do, but the murder rate among the Kung went down by a third after their territory had been brought under the control of the Botswana government, as the Leviathan theory would predict. The reduction of homicide by government control is so obvious to anthropologists that they seldom document it with numbers. The various paxes that one reads about in history books, the Pax Romana, Islamica, Mongolica, Hispanica, Ottomana, Sinica, Britannica, Australiana in New Guinea, Canadiana in the Pacific Northwest, and Praetoriana in South Africa, refer to the reduction in raiding, feuding, and warfare in the territories brought under the control of an effective government. Though imperial conquest and rule can themselves be brutal, they do reduce endemic violence among the conquered. The pacification process is so pervasive that anthropologists often treat it as a methodological nuisance. It goes without saying that peoples that have been brought under the jurisdiction of a government will not fight as much, so they are simply excluded from studies of violence in indigenous societies. The effect is also noticeable to the people themselves. As an Ayuyana man living in New Guinea under the Pax Australiana put it, life was better since the government came, because a man could now eat without looking over his shoulder and could leave his house in the morning to urinate without fear of being shot. The anthropologists Karen Erickson and Heather Horton have quantified the way that the presence of government can move a society away from lethal vengeance. In a survey of 192 traditional studies, they found that one-on-one revenge was common in foraging societies, and kin-against-kin blood feuds were common in tribal societies that had not been pacified by a colonial or national government, particularly if they had an exaggerated culture of manly honor. Adjudication by tribunals and courts, in contrast, was common in societies that had fallen under the control of a centralized government, or that had resource bases and inheritance patterns that gave people more of a stake in social stability. One of the tragic ironies of the second half of the 20th century is that when colonies in the developing world freed themselves from European rule, they often slid back into warfare, this time intensified by modern weaponry, organized militias, and the freedom of young men to defy tribal elders. As we shall see in the next chapter, this development is a countercurrent to the historical decline of violence, but it is also a demonstration of the role of Leviathans in propelling the decline. Civilization and its discontents. So did Hobbes get it right? In part, he did. In the nature of man, we find three principal causes of quarrel: gain, predatory raids; safety, preemptive raids; and reputation, retaliatory raids. And the numbers confirm that, relatively speaking, during the time men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and that in such condition they live in continual fear and danger of violent death. But from his armchair in 17th century England, Hobbes could not help but get a lot of it wrong. People in non-state societies cooperate extensively with their kin and allies, so life for them is far from solitary, and only intermittently is it nasty and brutish. Even if they are drawn into raids and battles every few years, that leaves a lot of time for foraging, feasting, singing, storytelling, child-rearing, tending to the sick, and the other necessities and pleasures of life. In a draft of a previous book, I casually referred to the Yanomamo as the fierce people, alluding to the title of the famous book by the anthropologist Napoleon Chagnon. An anthropologist colleague wrote in the margin, "Are the babies fierce? Are the old women fierce? Do they eat fiercely?" As for their lives being poor, the story is mixed. Certainly societies without an organized state enjoy no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, and no letters. Since it's hard to develop these things if the warriors from the next village keep waking you up with poisoned arrows, abducting the women, and burning your huts. But the first peoples who gave up hunting and gathering for settled agriculture struck a hard bargain for themselves. Spending your days behind a plow, subsisting on starchy cereal grains, and living cheek by jowl with livestock and thousands of other people can be hazardous to your health. Studies of skeletons by Steckel and his colleagues show that compared to hunter-gatherers, the first city dwellers were anemic, infected, tooth-decayed, and almost 2.5 inches shorter. Some biblical scholars believe that the story of the fall from the Garden of Eden was a cultural memory of the transition from foraging to agriculture. "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread." So why did our foraging ancestors leave Eden? For many, it was never an explicit choice. They had multiplied themselves into a Malthusian trap in which the fat of the land could no longer support them, and they had to grow their food themselves. The states emerged only later, and the foragers who lived at their frontiers could either be absorbed into them or hold out in their old way of life. For those that had the choice, Eden may have been just too dangerous. A few cavities, the odd abscess, and a couple of inches in height were a small price to pay for a fivefold better chance of not getting speared. The improved odds of a natural death came with another price, captured by the Roman historian Tacitus. "Formerly we suffered from crimes, Now we suffer from laws. The Bible stories we examined in chapter 1 suggest that the first kings kept their subjects in awe with totalistic ideologies and brutal punishments. Just think of the wrathful deity, watching people's every move, the regulation of daily life by arbitrary laws, the stonings for blasphemy and nonconformity, the kings with the power to expropriate a woman into their harem or cut a baby in half, the crucifixions of thieves and cult leaders. In these respects, the Bible was accurate. Social scientists who study the emergence of states have noted that they began as stratified theocracies in which elites secure their economic privileges by enforcing a brutal peace on their underlings. Three scholars have analyzed large samples of cultures to quantify the correlation between the political complexity of early societies and their reliance on absolutism and cruelty. The archaeologist Keith Otterbein has shown that societies with more centralized leadership were more likely to kill women in battles, as opposed to abducting them, to keep slaves, and to engage in human sacrifice. The sociologist Steven Spitzer has shown that complex societies are more likely to criminalize victimless activities like sacrilege, sexual deviance, disloyalty, and witchcraft, and to punish offenders by torture, mutilation, enslavement, and execution. And the historian and anthropologist Laura Betzig has shown that complex societies tend to fall under the control of despots, leaders who are guaranteed to get their way in conflicts, who can kill with impunity, and who have large harems of women at their disposal. She found that despotism in this case emerged among the Babylonians, Israelites, Romans, Samoans, Fijians, Khmer, Aztecs, Incas, Natchez of the lower Mississippi, Ashanti, and other kingdoms throughout Africa. When it came to violence, then, the first Leviathans solved one problem, but created another. People were less likely to become victims of homicide or casualties of war, but they were now under the thumbs of tyrants, clerics, and kleptocrats. This gives us the more sinister sense of the word, pacification, not just the bringing about of peace, but the imposition of absolute control by a coercive government. Solving this second problem would have to wait another few millennia, and in much of the world, it remains unsolved to this day. Chapter 3. The Civilizing Process. It is impossible to overlook the extent to which civilization is built upon a renunciation of instinct. Henry James. For as long as I have known how to eat with utensils, I have struggled with the rule of table manners that says you may not guide food onto your fork with your knife. To be sure, I have the dexterity to capture chunks of food that have enough mass to stay put as I scoot my fork under them, but my feeble cerebellum is no match for finely diced cubes or slippery little spheres that ricochet and roll at the touch of the tines. I chase them around the plate, desperately seeking a ridge or a slope that will give me the needed purchase, hoping they will not reach escape velocity and come to rest on the tablecloth. On occasion, I have seized the moment when my dining companion glances away and have placed my knife to block their getaway before she turns back to catch me in this faux pas. Anything to avoid the ignominy, the boorishness, the intolerable uncouthness of using a knife for some purpose other than cutting. Give me a lever long enough, said Archimedes, and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world. But if he knew his table manners, he could not have moved some peas onto his fork with his knife. I remember as a child questioning this pointless prohibition. What is so terrible, I asked, about using your silverware in an efficient and perfectly sanitary way? It's not as if I were asking to eat mashed potatoes with my hands. I lost the argument, as all children do, when faced with the rejoinder, because I said so. And for decades I silently grumbled about the unintelligibility of the rules of etiquette. Then one day, while doing research for this book, the scales fell from my eyes, the enigma evaporated, and I forever put aside my resentment of the no-knife rule. I owe this epiphany to the most important thinker you have never heard of, Norbert Elias, 1897 to 1990. Elias was born in Breslau, Germany, now Wrocław, Poland, and studied sociology and the history of science. He fled Germany in 1933 because he was Jewish, was detained in a British camp in 1940 because he was German, and lost both parents to the Holocaust. On top of these tragedies, Nazism brought one more into his life. His magnum opus, The Civilizing Process, was published in Germany in 1939, a time when the very idea seemed like a bad joke. Elias vagabonded from one university to another, mostly teaching night school, and retrained as a psychotherapist before settling down at the University of Leicester, where he taught until his retirement in 1962. He emerged from obscurity in 1969 when The Civilizing Process was published in English translation, and he was recognized as a major figure only in the last decade of his life, when an astonishing fact came to light. The discovery was not about the rationale behind table manners, but about the history of homicide. In 1981, the political scientist Ted Robert Gurr, using old court and county records, calculated 30 estimates of homicide rates at various times in English history, combined them with modern records from London, and plotted them on a graph. The graph shows that from the 13th century to the 20th, homicide in various parts of England plummeted by a factor of 10, 50, and in some cases 100. For example, from 110 homicides per 100,000 people per year in 14th century Oxford to less than one homicide per 100,000 in mid-20th century London. The graph stunned almost everyone who saw it, including me. As I mentioned in the preface, it was the seed that grew into this book. The discovery confounds every stereotype about the idyllic past and the degenerate present. When I surveyed perceptions of violence in an internet questionnaire, people guessed that 20th century England was about 14% more violent than 14th century England. In fact, it was 95% less violent. This chapter is about the decline of homicide in Europe from the Middle Ages to the present, and its counterparts and counterexamples in other times and places. I have borrowed the title of the chapter from Elias because he was the only major social thinker with a theory that could explain it. The European Homicide Decline. Before we try to explain this remarkable development, let's be sure it is real. Following the publication of Gurr's graph, several historical criminologists dug more deeply into the history of homicide. The criminologist Manuel Eisner assembled a much larger set of estimates on homicide in England across the centuries, drawing on coroners' inquests, court cases, and local records. By the 19th century, the British government was keeping annual records of homicide for the entire country. Another historian, J.S. Coburn, compiled continuous data from the town of Kent between 1560 and 1985. Once again, we see a decline in annual homicide rates, and it is not small. From between 4 and 100 homicides per 100,000 people in the Middle Ages to around 0.8, 8/10 of a homicide per 100,000 in the 1950s. The timing shows that the high medieval murder rates cannot be blamed on the social upheavals that followed the Black Death around 1350, because many of the estimates predated that epidemic. Eisner has given a lot of thought to how much we should trust these numbers. Homicide is the crime of choice for measurers of violence, because regardless of how the people of a distant culture conceptualize crime, a dead body is hard to define away, and it always arouses curiosity about who or what produced it. Records of homicide are therefore a more reliable index of violence than records of robbery, rape, or assault, and they usually, though not always, correlate with them. Still, it's reasonable to wonder how the people of different eras reacted to these killings. Were they as likely as we are to judge a killing as intentional or accidental, or to prosecute the killing as opposed to letting it pass? Did people in earlier times always kill at the same percentage of the rate that they are raped, robbed, and assaulted? How successful were they in saving the lives of victims of assault and thereby preventing them from becoming the victims of homicide? Fortunately, these questions can be addressed. Eisner cites studies showing that when people today are presented with the circumstances of a centuries-old murder and asked whether they think it was intentional, they usually come to the same conclusion as did the people at the time. He has shown that, in most periods, the rates of homicide do correlate with the rates of other violent crimes. He notes that any historical advance in forensics or in the reach of the criminal justice system is bound to underestimate the decline in homicide, because a greater proportion of killers are caught, prosecuted, and convicted today than they were centuries ago. As for life-saving medical care, doctors before the 20th century were quacks who killed as many patients as they saved. Yet most of the decline took place between 1300 and 1900. In any case, the sampling noise that gives social scientists such a headache when they are estimating a change of a quarter or a half is not as much of a problem when they are dealing with a change of tenfold or fiftyfold. Were the English unusual among Europeans in gradually refraining from murder? Eisner looked at other Western European countries for which criminologists had compiled homicide data, and the results were similar. Scandinavians needed a couple of additional centuries before they thought the better of killing each other, and Italians didn't get serious about it until the 19th century. But by the 20th century, the annual homicide rate of every Western European country had fallen into a narrow band centered on 1 per 100,000. To put the European decline in perspective, let's compare it to the rates for non-state societies that we encountered in Chapter 2. Even in the late Middle Ages, Western Europe was far less violent than the unpacified non-state societies and the Inuit, and it was comparable to the thinly settled foragers such as the Samai and the Hmong. And from the 14th century on, the European homicide rate sank steadily, with a tiny bounce in the last third of the 20th century. While Europe was becoming less murderous overall, certain patterns in homicide remained constant. Men were responsible for about 92% of the killings, other than infanticide, and they were most likely to kill when they were in their 20s. Until the 1960s uptick, cities were generally safer than the countryside. But other patterns changed. In the earlier centuries, the upper and lower social classes engaged in homicide at comparable rates. But as the homicide rate fell, it dropped far more precipitously among the upper classes than among the lower ones, an important social change to which we will return. Another historical change was that homicides in which one man kills another man who is unrelated to him declined far more rapidly than did the killing of children, parents, spouses, and siblings. This is a common pattern in homicide statistics, sometimes called Virchow's Law. Rates of male-on-male violence fluctuate more across different times and places than rates of domestic violence involving women or kin. Martin Daly and Margot Wilson's explanation is that family members get on each other's nerves at similar rates in all times and places because of deeply rooted conflicts of interest that are inherent to the patterns of genetic overlap among kin. Macho violence among male acquaintances, in contrast, is fueled by contests of dominance that are more sensitive to circumstances. How violent a man must be to keep his rank in the pecking order in a given milieu depends on his assessment of how violent the other men are, leading to vicious or virtuous circles that can spiral up or down precipitously. I'll explain the psychology of kinship in more detail in Chapter 7 and of dominance in Chapter 8. Explaining the European homicide decline. Now, let's consider the implications of the centuries-long decline in homicide in Europe. Do you think that city living, with its anonymity, crowding, immigrants, and jumble of cultures and classes, is a breeding ground for violence? What about the wrenching social changes brought on by capitalism and the Industrial Revolution? Is it your conviction that small-town life, centered on church, tradition, and fear of God, is our best bulwark against murder and mayhem? Well, think again. As Europe became more urban, cosmopolitan, commercial, industrialized, and secular, it got safer and safer. And that brings us back to the ideas of Norbert Elias, the only theory left standing. From a detail from a drawing called Saturn, Elias developed the theory of the civilizing process not by poring over numbers, which weren't available in his day, but by examining the texture of everyday life in medieval Europe. He examined, for instance, a series of drawings from the 15th century German manuscript, The Medieval Housebook, a depiction of daily life as seen through the eyes of a knight. In the drawing, a peasant disembowels a horse as a pig sniffs his exposed buttocks. In a nearby cave, a man and a woman sit in the stocks. Above them, a man is being led to the gallows, where a corpse is already hanging, and next to it is a man who has been broken on the wheel, his shattered body pecked by a crow. The wheel and gibbet are not the focal point of the drawing, but a part of the landscape, like the trees and hills. A detail from a second drawing, Mars, shows knights attacking a village. In the lower left, a peasant is stabbed by a soldier. Above him, another peasant is restrained by his shirt tail, while a woman, hands in the air, cries out. At the lower right, a peasant is being stabbed in a chapel while his possessions are plundered, and nearby, another peasant in fetters is cudgeled by a knight. Above them, a group of horsemen are setting fire to a farmhouse, while one of them drives off the farmer's cattle and strikes at his wife. The knights of feudal Europe were what today we would call warlords. States were ineffectual, and the king was merely the most prominent of the noblemen, with no permanent army and little control over the country. Governance was outsourced to the barons, knights, and other noblemen who controlled fiefs of various sizes, exacting crops and military service from the peasants who lived in them. The knights raided one another's territories in a Hobbesian dynamic of conquest, preemptive attack, and vengeance, and as the housebook illustrations suggest, they did not restrict their killing to other knights. In A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century, the historian Barbara Tuchman describes the way they made a living. These private wars were fought by the knights with furious gusto and a single strategy, which consisted in trying to ruin the enemy by killing and maiming as many of his peasants and destroying as many crops, vineyards, tools, barns, and other possessions as possible, thereby reducing his sources of revenue. As a result, the chief victim of the belligerents was their respective peasantry. As we saw in Chapter 1, to maintain the credibility of their deterrent threat, knights engaged in bloody tournaments and other demonstrations of macho prowess, gussied up with words like honor, valor, chivalry, glory, and gallantry, which made later generations forget they were bloodthirsty marauders. The private wars and tournaments were the backdrop to a life that was violent in other ways. As we saw, religious values were imparted with bloody crucifixes, threats of eternal torture, and prurient depictions of mutilated saints. Craftsmen applied their ingenuity to sadistic machines of punishment and execution. Brigands made travel a threat to life and limb, and ransoming captives was big business. As Elias noted, the little people too, the hatters, the tailors, the shepherds, were all quick to draw their knives. Even clergymen got into the act. The historian Barbara Hannawalt quotes an account from 14th century England. It happened at Ilvertoft on Saturday next before Matin Mass, in the fifth year of King Edward, that a certain William of Wellington, parish chaplain of Ilvertoft, sent John, his clerk, to John Cobbler's house to buy a candle for him for a penny. But John would not send it to him without the money. Wherefore William became enraged and, knocking in the door upon him, he struck John in the front part of the head so that his brains flowed forth, and he died forthwith. Violence pervaded their entertainment as well. Tuchman describes two of the popular sports of the time. Players with hands tied behind them competed to kill a cat nailed to a post by battering it to death with their heads, at the risk of cheeks ripped open or eyes scratched out by the frantic animal's claws. Or a pig, enclosed in a wide pen, was chased by men with clubs, to the laughter of spectators, as he ran squealing from the blows until beaten lifeless. During my decades in academia, I have read thousands of scholarly papers on a vast range of topics, from the grammar of irregular verbs to the physics of multiple universes. But the oddest journal article I have ever read is Losing Face, Saving Face, Noses and Honor in the Late Medieval Town. Here the historian Valentin Grobner documents dozens of accounts from medieval Europe in which one person cut off the nose of another. Sometimes it was an official punishment for heresy, treason, prostitution, or sodomy, but more often it was an act of private vengeance. In one case in Nuremberg in 1520, Hans Riegel had an affair with the wife of Hans von Eib. A jealous von Eib cut off the nose of Riegel's innocent wife, a supreme injustice multiplied by the fact that Riegel was sentenced to 4 weeks of imprisonment for adultery, while von Eib walked away scot-free. These mutilations were so common that, according to Grobner, the authors of late medieval surgical textbooks also devote particular attention to nasal injuries, discussing whether a nose once cut off can grow back, a controversial question that the French royal physician Henri de Mondeville answered in his famous Chirurgia with a categorical no. Other 15th century medical authorities were more optimistic. Heinrich von Forspunt's 1460 Pharmacopoeia promised, among other things, a prescription for making a new nose for those who had lost theirs. The practice was the source of our strange idiom, to cut off your nose to spite your face. In late medieval times, cutting off someone's nose was the prototypical act of spite. Like other scholars who have peered into medieval life, Elias was taken aback by accounts of the temperament of medieval people, who by our lights seem impetuous, uninhibited, almost childlike. Not that all people were always going around with fierce looks, drawn brows, and martial countenances. On the contrary, a moment ago they were joking, now they mock each other. One word leads to another, and suddenly, from the midst of laughter, they find themselves in the fiercest feud. Much of what appears contradictory to us, the intensity of their piety, the violence of their fear of hell, their guilt feelings, their penitence, the immense outbursts of joy and gaiety, the sudden flaring and the uncontrollable force of their hatred and belligerence, all these, like the rapid changes of mood, are in reality symptoms of one and the same structuring of the emotional life. The drives, the emotions were vented more freely, more directly, more openly than later. It is only to us, in whom everything is more subdued, moderate, and calculated, and in whom social taboos are built much more deeply into the fabric of our drive economy as self-restraints, that the unveiled intensity of this piety, belligerence, or cruelty appears to be contradictory. Tuckman, too, writes of the childishness noticeable in medieval behavior, with its marked inability to restrain any kind of impulse. Dorothy Sayers, in the introduction to her translation of The Song of Roland, adds, "The idea that a strong man should react to great personal and national calamities by a slight compression of the lips and by silently throwing his cigarette into the fireplace is of very recent origin." Though the childishness of the medievals was surely exaggerated, there may indeed be differences in degree in the mores of emotional expression in different eras. Elias spends much of The Civilizing Process documenting this transition with an unusual database, Manuals of Etiquette. Today we think of these books, like Amy Vanderbilt's Everyday Etiquette and Miss Manners' Guide to Excruciatingly Correct Behavior, as sources of handy tips for avoiding embarrassing peccadillos. But at one time they were serious guides to moral conduct, written by the leading thinkers of the day. In 1530, the great scholar Desiderius Erasmus, one of the founders of modernity, wrote an etiquette manual called On Civility in Boys, which was a bestseller throughout Europe for two centuries. By laying down rules for what people ought not to do, these manuals give us a snapshot of what they must have been doing. The people of the Middle Ages were, in a word, gross. A number of the advisories in the etiquette books deal with eliminating bodily effluvia. Don't foul the staircases, corridors, closets, or wall hangings with urine or other filth. Don't relieve yourself in front of ladies or before doors or windows of court chambers. Don't slide back and forth on your chair as if you're trying to pass gas. Don't touch your private parts under your clothes with your bare hands. Don't greet someone while they are urinating or defecating. Don't make noise when you pass gas. Don't undo your clothes in front of other people in preparation for defecating, or do them up afterwards. When you share a bed with someone in an inn, don't lie so close to him that you touch him, and don't put your legs between his. If you come across something disgusting in the sheet, don't turn to your companion and point it out to him, or hold up the stinking thing for the other to smell and say, "I should like to know how much that stinks." Others deal with blowing one's nose. Don't blow your nose onto the tablecloth or into your fingers, sleeve, or hat. Don't offer your used handkerchief to someone else. Don't carry your handkerchief in your mouth. Nor is it seemly, after wiping your nose, to spread out your handkerchief and peer into it, as if pearls and rubies might have fallen out of your head. Then there are fine points of spitting. Don't spit into the bowl when you are washing your hands. Do not spit so far that you have to look for the saliva to put your foot on it. Turn away when spitting, lest your saliva fall on someone. If anything purulent falls to the ground, it should be trodden upon, lest it nauseate someone. If you notice saliva on someone's coat, it is not polite to make it known. And there are many, many pieces of advice on table manners. Don't be the first to take from the dish. Don't fall on the food like a pig, snorting and smacking your lips. Don't turn the serving dish around so the biggest piece of meat is near you. Don't wolf your food like you're about to be carried off to prison, nor push so much food into your mouth that your cheeks bulge like bellows, nor pull your lips apart so that they make a noise like pigs. Don't dip your fingers into the sauce in the serving dish. Don't put a spoon into your mouth and then use it to take food from the serving dish. Don't gnaw on a bone and put it back in the serving dish. Don't wipe your utensils on the tablecloth. Don't put back on your plate what has been in your mouth. Do not offer anyone a piece of food you have bitten into. Don't lick your greasy fingers. Wipe them on the bread or wipe them on your coat. Don't lean over to drink from your soup bowl. Don't spit bones, pits, eggshells, or rinds into your hand or throw them on the floor. Don't pick your nose while eating. Don't drink from your dish. Use a spoon. Don't slurp from your spoon. Don't loosen your belt at the table. Don't clean a dirty plate with your fingers. Don't stir sauce with your fingers. Don't lift meat to your nose to smell it. Don't drink coffee from your saucer. In the mind of a modern reader, these advisories set off a train of reactions. How inconsiderate, how boorish, how animalistic, how immature those people must have been. These are the kinds of directives you'd expect a parent to give to a 3-year-old, not a great philosopher to a literate readership. Yet as Elias points out, the habits of refinement, self-control, and consideration that are second nature to us had to be acquired. That's why we call them second nature, and they developed in Europe over the course of its modern history. The sheer quantity of the advice tells a story. The 36-odd rules are not interdependent of one another, but exemplify a few themes. It's unlikely that each of us today had to be instructed in every rule individually, so that if some mother had been remiss in teaching one of them, her adult son would still be blowing his nose into the tablecloth. The rules in the list, and many more that are not, are deducible from a few principles. Control your appetites. Delay gratification. Consider the sensibilities of others. Don't act like a peasant. Distance yourself from your animal nature. And the penalty for these infractions was assumed to be internal, a sense of shame. Elias notes that the etiquette books rarely mention health and hygiene. Today we recognize that the emotion of disgust evolved as an unconscious defense against biological contamination. But an understanding of microbes and infection did not arrive until well into the 19th century. The only explicit rationales stated in the etiquette books are to avoid acting like a peasant or an animal and to avoid offending others. In the European Middle Ages, sexual activity, too, was less discreet. People were publicly naked more often, and couples took only perfunctory measures to keep their coitus private. Prostitutes offered their services openly. In many English towns, the red light district was called Gropecunt Lane. Men would discuss their sexual exploits with their children, and a man's illegitimate offspring would mix with his legitimate ones. During the transition to modernity, this openness came to be frowned upon as uncouth and then as unacceptable. The change left its mark in the language. Words for peasantry took on a second meaning as words for turpitude. Boor, which originally just meant farmer, as in the German Bauer and Dutch Boer, villain from the French Villain, a serf or villager, churlish from English churl, a commoner, vulgar, common, as in the term vulgate, and ignoble, not an aristocrat. Many of the words for the fraud actions and substances became taboo. Englishmen used to swear by invoking supernatural beings, as in My God and Jesus Christ. At the start of the modern era, they began to invoke sexuality and excretion, and the Anglo-Saxon four-letter words, as we call them today, could no longer be used in polite company. As the historian Geoffrey Hughes has noted, the days when the dandelion could be called the pissabed, a heron could be called a shit crow, and the windhover could be called the windfucker, have passed away with the exuberant phallic advertisement of the codpiece. Bastard, cunt, arse, and whore also passed from ordinary to taboo. As the new etiquette book took hold, it also applied to the accoutrements of violence, particularly knives. In the Middle Ages, most people carried a knife and would use it at the dinner table to carve a chunk of meat off the roasted carcass, spear it, and bring it to their mouths. But the menace of a lethal weapon within reach at a communal gathering, and the horrific image of a knife pointed at a face, became increasingly repellent. Elias cites a number of points of etiquette that center on the use of knives. Don't pick your teeth with your knife. Don't hold your knife the entire time you are eating, but only when you are using it. Don't use the tip of your knife to put food into your mouth. Don't cut bread. Break it. If you pass someone a knife, take the point in your hand and offer him the handle. Don't clutch your knife with your whole hand like a stick, but hold it in your fingers. Don't use your knife to point at someone. It was during this transition that the fork came into common use as a table utensil, so that people no longer had to bring their knives to their mouths. Special knives were set at the table so people would not have to unsheathe their own, and they were designed with rounded rather than pointed ends. Certain foods were never to be cut with a knife, such as fish, round objects, and bread, whence the expression, to break bread together. Some of the medieval knife taboos remain with us today. Many people will not give a knife as a present unless it is accompanied by a coin, which the recipient gives back to make the transaction a sale rather than a gift. The ostensible reason is to avoid the symbolism of severing the friendship, but a more likely reason is to avoid the symbolism of directing an unsolicited knife in the friend's direction. A similar superstition makes it bad luck to hand someone a knife. One is supposed to lay it down on the table and allow the recipient to pick it up. Knives in table settings are rounded at the end and no sharper than needed. Steak knives are brought out for tough meat, and blunter knives substituted for fish. And knives may be used only when they are absolutely necessary. It's rude to use a knife to eat a piece of cake, to bring food to your mouth, to mix ingredients. Stir with a knife, stir up strife, or to push food onto your fork. Aha! Elias's theory, then, attributes the decline in European violence to a larger psychological change. The subtitle of his book is Sociogenetic and Psychogenetic Investigations. He proposed that over a span of several centuries, beginning in the 11th or 12th and maturing in the 17th and 18th, Europeans increasingly inhibited their impulses, anticipated the long-term consequences of their actions, and took other people's thoughts and feelings into consideration. A culture of honor, the readiness to take revenge, gave way to a culture of dignity, the readiness to control one's emotions. These ideals originated in explicit instructions that cultural arbiters gave to aristocrats and noblemen, allowing them to differentiate themselves from the villains and boors. But they were then absorbed into the socialization of younger and younger children until they became second nature. The standards also trickled down from the upper classes to the bourgeoisie that strove to emulate them, and from them to the lower classes, eventually becoming a part of the culture as a whole. Elias helped himself to Freud's structural model of the psyche, in which children acquire a conscience, the superego, by internalizing the injunctions of their parents when they are too young to understand them. At that point, the child's ego can apply these injunctions to keep their biological impulses, the id, in check. Elias stayed away from Freud's more exotic claims, such as the primeval parasite, the death instinct, and the Oedipal complex, and his psychology is thoroughly modern. In Chapter 9, we will look at a faculty of the mind that psychologists call self-control, delay of gratification, and shallow temporal discounting, and that lay people call counting to 10, holding your horses, biting your tongue, saving for a rainy day, and keeping your pecker in your pocket. We will also look at a faculty that psychologists call empathy, intuitive psychology, perspective taking, and theory of mind, and that lay people call getting into other people's heads, seeing the world from their point of view, walking a mile in their moccasins, and feeling their pain. Elias anticipated the scientific study of both of these better angels. Critics of Elias have pointed out that all societies have standards of propriety about sexuality and excretion, which presumably grow out of innate emotions surrounding purity, disgust, and shame. As we will see, the degree to which societies moralize these emotions is a major dimension of variation across cultures. Though medieval Europe certainly did not lack norms of propriety altogether, it seems to have lain at the far end of the envelope of cultural possibilities. To his credit, Elias leapfrogged academic fashion in not claiming that early modern Europeans invented or constructed self-control. He claimed only that they toned up a mental faculty that had always been a part of human nature, but which the medievals had underused. He repeatedly drove the point home with the pronouncement, "There is no zero point." As we shall see in Chapter 9, exactly how people dial their capacity for self-control up or down is an interesting topic in psychology. One possibility is that self-control is like a muscle, so that if you exercise it with table manners, it will be stronger across the board, and more effective when you have to stop yourself from killing the person who just insulted you. Another possibility is that a particular setting of the self-control dial is a social norm, like how close you can stand to another person, or how much of your body has to be covered in public. A third is that self-control can be adjusted adaptively according to its costs and benefits in the local environment. Self-control, after all, is not an unmitigated good. The problem with having too much self-control is that an aggressor can use it to his advantage, anticipating that you may hold back from retaliating because it's too late to do any good. But if he had reason to believe that you would lash out reflexively, consequences be damned, he might treat you with more respect in the first place. In that case, people might adjust the self-control slider according to the dangerousness of those around him. At this point in the story, the theory of the